everybody. Welcome. It is episode number 200.
I hate you for that.
Of the SoxProspects.com podcast. We are the web's number one source for information on the Boston Red Sox farm system from Fort Myers to Worcester, up the Pike to Fenway, and all stops in between. Thank you for listening. My name is Chris Hatfield. I am the executive editor of Sox Prospects. I am joined for this introduction by our director of scouting, Ian Kundle. And Ian, we are joined today by a very special guest.
I think we should tell him now.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you think? Yeah. I'm sure they've read the title
it's
of the
episode. Probably in the title, but yeah.
Yeah. We're joined today by Red Sox Chief Baseball Officer Chaim Bloom.
Yeah.
I told you we had a good one. You didn't believe me, but I told you. I'm curious how many people got the Nirvana reference.
I didn't get it.
Well, you're a child.
No, I'm not, but I didn't
get
it.
Basically a child. The song is called In Bloom. Anyway, all right. We got Chaim Bloom. We talked with him about a lot of stuff. It went really well. We talked about his beginnings in baseball. We talked about coming over to the Red Sox. What did he want to change? What did he want to keep intact? What else, Ian? We talked about, any number of things. We talked about women in baseball front offices.
Yep.
We talked about
how COVID impacted plans, how it changed everything, basically, the season.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about pitching development. We went all over the board.
Yeah, it's all over the map.
Pretty much everything.
We didn't, if you're waiting for the, are you going to sign anybody question, we didn't do that because there's no point to that because the reason is because no one signed anybody, people. It's starting to move, but
yeah,
we'll see. They're going to do more stuff. Trust me. We tried not to ask the questions that you have already heard asked of Chaim Bloom.
Yeah.
I think is a fair way to put it. We didn't want to tread ground that had already been tread with him. And honestly, look, there's questions that he can't answer.
Yeah,
right.
And I think that's the biggest thing people need to remember is that I'm sure there's stuff that we would have loved to know about or ask, but it's at the end of the day, it's not in his interest or in anyone's interest for those questions to be answered.
Yeah. And we asked about the trade deadline. We asked about learning about how the minor leagues work and how that affected his development, how it influenced his development.
We had a really interesting discussion about the impact analytics has had on the game of baseball and kind of how what has happened to baseball, piggybacking off a Theo Epstein quote about how the game of baseball has changed and whether it's for the best or for the worst. So that was a very interesting discussion or kind of answer he had there.
Yep. It's a great interview.
You guys are going to like it. It's a great interview, yeah.
He gave us an hour that I did not think we were going to get more than 30 minutes.
It was great.
Yeah, it was terrific. And we don't get to do things like this if we don't have support of the listeners out there. So thank you all for downloading. And we don't get to do this without the support of our Patreon supporters. And as always, we want to thank everyone who supports us at patreon.com/SoxProspects, especially our $5 level Patreon supporters. That'd be Kyle Costigan, Tyler Woodrall, Jeff Traynor, David Nardone, Tim Tarding, Bill Stanton, Deb Kendall, Evan Kirkwood, Hurricanes 1, Chris Fox, James O'Hara, Nathan Kenyon, Andrew Wallen, David B., Ben Burnett, Al Mendel, Kevin Catrides, Ben NRI, Paul Denyer, Lendl Martin, Cassandra Buchta, James P. McMahon, Stephen Gregory, James Bailey, Andreas Gulstrand, Corey Perich, and Forrest Perkins. And of course, as always, send your emails to podcast@soxprospects.com. We want to talk about what you want to hear about. No emails today because we recorded an episode like 2 days ago. That's just how the schedule wound up working out when the CBO says what day he can talk, you talk on that day.
Exactly.
So, the one thing we do need to do is there's one bit of news we should talk quickly about, Ian, and that's the trade of CJ Chatham to the Philadelphia Phillies.
Mm-hmm.
The Red Sox this week traded, essentially DFA'd him, basically. Traded him for a player to be named later or cash.
Yep. And I think I think on the last episode we talked about speculating about what the potential counter move for the Martin Perez signing was going to be. And of the hitters, it was Chatham if they weren't going to do the Pedroia thing, which I think it was Pete Abe actually had some clarity on that.
Oh yeah. We should mention that too.
We'll talk about that after.
Yeah.
But taking the Pedroia situation out of it, for me, what was left on the roster, Chatham was the only hitter it made sense who was going to go. And there's a few pitchers, but I get why it was him. You know,
yeah,
he was the second round pick for the Red Sox back in 2016. You know, we've talked to him endlessly on here what the problems with him are. He can't stay healthy. There's just not a lot of offensive potential, and the defense is not good enough to make up for that, in my opinion. You know, he's a solid defender at shortstop.
He can feel the position.
But it's not like an elite glove, and that's to have his type of offensive profile, you need an elite glove to become a long-term major leaguer. And he just doesn't have that. And I think the writing was kind of on the wall when last year they didn't call him up at all. He was only with the Red Sox in like a taxi squad role, I think, a few times. But even as they were having, you know, second base problems and at the end of the season, they didn't give him a chance there. It was just, it seemed like both sides were kind of ready to move on, and he needs to change the scenery, and hopefully going to Philadelphia, he can figure some things out there, maybe swing change, who knows, but there's opportunity there. I mean, they don't really have a shortstop on their 40-man roster now either, but for the Red Sox, it does.
Well, they do. It's just, it's Arraigns and it's Downs.
No, I'm talking about the Phillies.
Oh, the Phillies. Sorry.
Phillies. The Phillies don't, because Didi Gregorius is a free agent. So maybe he can, you know, find a niche role there. But kind of, yeah, piggybacking to the Red Sox, it does put them in an interesting position that I think their bench signing has to be able to play shortstop.
Or a second baseman that can do both. Like if you sign Marcus Semien to play second.
He would be perfect.
Or if you get like a can Kike Hernandez play a little bit of short?
I don't believe he did last year, but let me look.
I think he has.
He definitely has in the past. They were They were linked with him again today. But yeah, it puts him in an interesting position because, as you said, Jonathan Arauz is now the only backup who can play shortstop Downs. On the 40-man. Yeah, but Downs.
Well, Downs isn't on the 40-man yet. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Downs exactly. Downs is not in the 40-man. But he's the only guy who has any big league experience who's played shortstop, you know, and usually teams will have somebody who like that, like a older, because Arauz is someone you need to send back to the minors. So I don't know what they're going to do there. Looking at Hernandez, he played shortstop for 2 games last year.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, you've got Arauz on the roster, but it's like, I mean, I guess you could call up Downs at some point if you needed someone, but even like Christian Arroyo,
he hasn't played in a few years. That's why I think that whoever they either need to find a bench person who can play it, or the second base acquisition needs to be able to play shortstop.
Yeah,
because
and then
I just
someone
don't
on
think,
the bench can play second.
Yeah, because I just don't think you can go into the season with Xander Bogaerts as your only shortstop. It just doesn't seem
well, only
like
shortstop
a good idea.
On the 40. Like, right? Because you don't want to call – you want to give Arauz a full season in the minor leagues.
Correct.
He held his own last year, but like he needs to develop.
Well, remember, he jumped straight from, what was it, high A to the majors?
Yeah, and I mean, if you think about, I mean, like, even looking at our projected... Double A. Even looking at our...
Copy in Double A.
Yeah, even if we look at our projected Triple A roster right now, our projected shortstop is Arauz. Downs is at second. He can play short. They're probably going to alternate the two middle infield positions.
Yeah.
Yairo Munoz, not really a shortstop.
Nope.
Chad De La Guerra, not really a shortstop. It. You go down to Double A, maybe you've got like a Jeremy Rivera who's
That's why they re-signed Rivera. You know, if you think about it, before Rivera re-signed last week, and we didn't really touch on in the last episode that long, Ryan Fitzgerald was the only guy who would even play shortstop on our projected Double A roster. And it's just, it kind of goes down the system that in the high minors, they just don't have a lot of guys who play shortstop. It's
they
just
have
kind
a
of
ton
how
in the low minors.
Yeah, because they are all in the low minors, but that's just how the cookies kind of crumbled. And I think that's why going out and re-signing Rivera is good. And I think while they moved on from Chatham, I think that we will see them address that in some capacity.
I think that's right.
And then I don't think there's a lot to say about Chatham. Yeah. Like, obviously, it turned out in a second-round pick. It didn't work out. But I get what they were looking. I get what they saw with him, if that makes sense. If you look back, it wasn't that much of a reach. You know, it's just some guys' development just doesn't work out, you know.
Now, I saw him being referred to as a bust, and I don't agree with that at all. I mean, that was the 13 draft, right? No, that was 16?
Yeah, 2016.
Okay, it seems like he's been in the system forever.
Yeah, he's
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a problem with him getting 1.1, getting drafted at the 51st pick. He's athletic. You see the body. He looks the part. He can field short, and you can see if the bat develops, that's a regular, and the bat just didn't develop. Like they
exactly, and that's why, as I kind of alluded to earlier, the defense is good enough to play shortstop. I think you play third, second. You probably stick him at first, given his height, and he can play corner outfield, which he started doing a little bit last year.
Yeah.
he would give good defensive versatility. It's just his bat never came along, and that's just was the limiting reactant there.
Yeah, and I mean, we'll see. You know, he's not dead. You know, he's not retiring. But it's weird. Someone else said that draft, you know, it's all on Bobby Dalbecker. It's a bust. I don't know that. I mean, they drafted Sean Anderson in the third. That's a major leaguer. Dahlbeck's a major leaguer. Mike Schwarren's a major leaguer. Steven Nogosek's a major leaguer. Santiago Espinal's a major leaguer. Kyle Hart is a major leaguer. There's major leaguers in this group, and that's not to mention Jay Groom, who's still, the jury's not out on him being a major leaguer.
I mean, I don't think it's going to produce an impact player, but they've got six major leaguers right now, and I think there's a chance that you still have a chance with Groom. So
there's still a chance with Chatham. I think Chatham plays in the majors.
Oh, I think Chatham will play in the majors at some point. Yeah. So yeah, if you can get seven guys making the majors from a draft is still pretty impressive.
Yeah. Well, if both of them, that would be eight, yeah.
But yeah, they just didn't get that impact player is the issue.
Well, I think Dahlbeck could still be an impact player. I think it's premature to say that it didn't, but it doesn't look likely.
Fair.
Is maybe what I would say more. But it's not a bad draft. I mean, they used Anderson in a trade. They used Nogosek in a trade. They used Espinal in a trade. They used Espinal to get Steven Pierce, guys. Come on.
Yeah, that was a good trade.
That worked out all right.
Sean Anderson was...
I don't think they...
Eduardo Nunez. That was an important player.
Yeah, they trade with Gregory Santos. So Santos is the one you would want to have back there.
Yeah.
And Nogosek was the deal to get Addison Reed, which didn't go anywhere. But
yeah.
All right, fair enough. And then the Pedroia news. When this was happening, like, it was kind of like, okay, Grillon was one thing. Now Chatham, why is Pedroia still on the roster? Is where some people were starting to go. Which I get. I was one of those people. But it also, when you think about it more, look at the number of holes this team has. They're going to need plenty more 40-man spots.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be moves to come in to make room. There's going to be some guys let go.
And Pete Abraham of the Boston Globe did do the legwork and reported that Pedroia is not planning on coming back. What's the tweet, Ian? Do you have it up? It's Pedroia's not coming back, and they're working something out with him. It's going to be in the next month or so, or two.
Yeah, it was something along those lines. Yeah. I might find it.
Because the thing is, just to remind everybody, Pedroia gets paid as long as he doesn't retire. Pedroia should not retire. He earned that money. If put it this way, if you get hurt on the job and you're collecting workers' comp, you're not going to like give it up because it's better for your former employer. You're going to collect the money.
Yeah, like, I don't blame him for not retiring.
He shouldn't retire. You think he should retire, that's a terrible take. Okay. Yeah. Now the Red Sox could use his roster spot, and what they should do is come to an agreement to release him gracefully.
Yeah.
And you know, you quote hire him to earn his money in the front office or something.
Do like what David Wright did. Well, no, he would still, if they release him, he'd still get his money. So
salary, which counts against the CBT, to do something in the front office.
David Wright did.
Yes, exactly.
The Mets. Yeah, because what the Pete Abe tweet was, did some checking. Pedroia is not planning to come back, and a resolution could come this month. Given Dustin's status, they'll want to do this correctly. Also, fair to say, they haven't dropped anyone off the 40-man they saw as having an impact, but they're running low on those, which I think I agree with everything he said there.
I think there's two guys left that I would DFA and not have a problem with it.
Yep. And so, yeah, I think that's kind of where we are, and hope we'll probably get some clarity on that, it seems, in the next month or so. And, yeah, we'll go from there.
All right. We are not going to come back after the interview as per our usual style. Now, we want to thank all of you for listening. We want to thank Chaim freaking Bloom for coming on the show.
Yeah.
That was cool.
It was a very cool interview.
It was very, very, very cool. Yeah, no, it was, he's a great dude. We appreciate, I just called the CBO a great dude. it was a great interview. We appreciated him taking an hour with us. We want to thank Podcast Joe 2.0. for helping us put the show together. We want to thank all of you for listening. Follow us on Twitter. You can follow the site at Sox Prospects. You can follow Ian at Ian Kundal. That's IANCUNDALL. You can follow me at SP Chris Hatfield. Heim works for an organization called the Boston Red Sox. You can follow them at Red Sox.
and also make sure to follow us on Instagram.
At Sox Prospects.
Yeah, at Sox Prospects on Instagram. We have a new hire who's going to start doing some work there. And so we're going to start having some cool stuff up on there. So check that out. And
we're excited to kind of get that going. And when he says follow us, we just mean the site account.
Yes.
Don't try and follow me. I'm not going to allow you.
Yeah, no, follow the site account, because we're going to have some cool stuff on there and kind of integrate it in with
good
some of the
call,
stuff we're doing in other places.
Good call. And also, sorry about my dog barking. You'll hear
it. It only happened once. We'll let it go.
You'll hear it. It's not great. It's all right. We still love her anyway. Adopt, don't shop, people. All right. Here's Chaim Bloom. Thank you all for listening. Hope you all enjoy the interview as much as we did doing it. Okay, and for our 200th episode spectacular, we are pleased to join the chief baseball officer of the Boston Red Sox, Chaim Bloom. Chaim, thank you for coming on the show. It's a pleasure to have you. It's certainly been an interesting first year for you as the CBO of the Red Sox. Which, by the way, I think you must be the only chief baseball officer. Is that whose idea was chief baseball officer? I think is the hard hitting first question I need to ask.
First question I didn't anticipate. Well, first of all, thanks guys for having me. It's good to be on. It's good to meet you guys and get to know you a little bit. I don't know who came up with that title necessarily. I think that it has been a fairly exclusive club of people who have held that title in the game of baseball. I think it's me and Derek Falvey and Tony La Russa, and the two of them have different titles and in one case a different job now. So I think I'm the last one. That's the torch I'm carrying.
All right. Excellent. Well, we appreciate you coming on CBO, PBOPs or GM, whatever the title is. There's a lot we want to get into with you coming off of we were talking a little bit about this before, but the first year that you had to go through with the challenges that were presented to you, that, you know, some that you probably knew going in, some that you certainly couldn't have known going in, between having to find a new manager basically on the eve of spring training, the team maybe not doing quite as well as you might have expected, a global pandemic certainly was not something you would have been prepared for. I guess just looking back on that year you had, and then we'll kind of maybe dial back to the beginning a little bit for you. How, coming through that, are you better for it? I mean, taking your lumps like in a given year, like you just had at any time would be tough. But in your first year kind of running the show, obviously a challenge, but as far as being prepared, what have you taken from it? What have you learned? How has that particular first year experience affected you or given you anything to work from?
Yeah, it was challenging to say the least. Some of those challenges, like you said, I knew were part of the job. Mm-hmm. And I knew there would be some challenges, you know, on my plate and on our plates as a front office as soon as I came in here. Some of them were unanticipated. Certainly everything that happened once the Houston report came down, and then obviously the pandemic, losing Sale, although that's a little more within the normal range of bad things that can happen to baseball teams. So it's definitely unusual. I like to think that, you know, we do best when we sort of set ourselves up to learn and grow both from success and from challenge. And the year certainly brought a lot of challenges. You know, there were some bright spots, but certainly a lot of challenges. I think the biggest one for me is, you know, just so much of how I thought my first year would go would be in the spaces between what was on, you know, my calendar or on a formal schedule, where you get to hang out with people, you get to build relationships, really look under the hood of the organization and try to understand what makes it tick in a way that you can't see from the outside. And that was hard to do this year. In some cases, we weren't able as an organization, as an industry, to do some of the things that we normally do. So you couldn't see people and programs in action. It was tough to even assess some of how we operate because we weren't operating at all normally. Though some of those challenges bring out some, you know, creativity in people, and you get to see them in different lights. So it wasn't a total loss. But I think the bigger thing, just, you know, we have a large staff of about a couple hundred people. And to me, like, organizations succeed not because someone in my chair beats, you know, my counterparts. It's because our 200 people beat everybody else's 200 people. That's what makes organizations great. And I wanted to really build relationships and get to know those folks. And a lot of that happens best, in the more casual time when you're hanging out. And there's no hanging out in COVID, unless you do it on Zoom, and that's not the same. So, you know, we have done a lot of Zooms. Some of them have been during business hours, and some of them have been, you know, after dark, where everybody's got a beer in front of them, if that's their or their beverage of choice. But it's still not the same. But we've tried to work around it. And I think by working through these challenges together, and the year brought a lot of challenges. I mean, it wasn't just, you know, the pandemic. It wasn't just obviously the economic effects of the pandemic, our on-field performance. But we had some, you know, we had some tragedy in the organization. It started really even, in January, and, you know, we're coming up on the anniversary of this when JJ Altobelli lost his dad in the crash that, you know, killed Kobe and then lost his sister. And, you know, those are times when I think you get to see an organization come together. You get to see what the culture of an organization is made of. And, you know, it's tragic. And there are a few times during the year when we had chances to see the Red Sox family in action for various reasons, and it was as advertised. So that's a wonderful thing to experience.
Yeah, I mean, you look at, you know, with JJ getting a draft pick in a year when you guys had four picks, you know, getting a draft pick signed in any year is usually a big thing for a scout, especially a young one like JJ. And then the perseverance, I know I mentioned that to Paul on the call after the draft, and he mentioned that was a really good moment for the Red Sox family. It may not have been his words, but to use yours, you're right, just kind of the opportunity to move back to do that. Let's look back a little bit at what kind of prepared you for a year like this. And going back, of course, much has been said about, you know, you got your start writing one piece in high school and then several while you were at Yale for Baseball Prospectus, including, I might add, of particular note for our longtime listeners and readers, a Q&A with Charlie Zink.
Yep. I had completely forgotten that. That is accurate. About. Yes.
Which was pretty great. So there's a connection there, not to mention the overlap with Craig Breslow a little bit while you were there. Did you happen to know Breslow at all?
I didn't.
Okay.
No.
He was a couple of years older than you. Anyway.
Yeah, a couple years older and way more athletic. So if I wanted to spend time around the baseball team, I had to buy a ticket.
Fair enough. I guess what I'm curious about is what got you interested in looking at baseball in that way, in the sense that it's not that sabermetrics or generally thinking about the game in a different way was a new concept at that time, but it wasn't like now where there's all kinds of fan graphs and, you know, you're writing about that in all kinds of mainstream outlets. BP was really one of the only places doing that. You know, I think I saw one of the pieces that had your byline was co-bylined with Clay Davenport of like the Davenport translations. Like, mm-hmm. You know, this is kind of when it was starting to kind of blow up a little bit. What kind of led you to start looking at the game in that particular sense, as opposed to just your standard sort of fan, read the stats on the back of the baseball card, follow the team, watch the game sense?
Yeah, I came to it as a kid, really more as a fan, and got interested in the history of the game, but still really from a fan's perspective. And it was some point that I never actually wrote an article in high school. I think that's like a miscredit on the site, but it was sometime late high school, early college, when I started to, just aspire to work in the game as a career and try to figure out how to do that. And I can't remember exactly how I came across, you know, the sort of budding analytics world within baseball, but, you know, BP was certainly, like you said, one of the main, if not the main outlet for that in the public domain. And it just opened my eyes to, you know, a couple things between that and then seeing what was going on in the game, that there were a lot of different ways to look at this game and just to use critical thinking skills and evidence to learn more about the game of baseball and maybe in a way that could impact it on the field and could help a team. And then I also started to see that there were paths in baseball for people with backgrounds like mine, which now we sort of take for granted, but at the time that was not necessarily something that was taken for granted. There were a few people in the game, and then certainly it became more high profile once Theo came here, and obviously Moneyball came out, and then the room was a little more crowded after that. But it just opened my eyes to both something that I found really interesting, and that also there was a possibility, you know, however remote, of someone like me being able to contribute.
And then that leads to you getting into the game. I think it was as an intern with the Padres and then at MLB before you landed as an intern with the Rays in 2005. Just as far as getting in the game, what was becoming a, you know, well, I'll use the general term GM, but, you know, leading a front office, running a team, was that always the goal, or was it just a general, I love this, I want to get into the game, here's this internship with the pods and then MLB, and then let's go, you know, starting up with the Rays.
You know, I guess in the abstract, if you put me on the spot, I might have said that was the goal, but it wasn't really how I thought about it. It was really just something I was excited to get into and just see where it took me. Mm-hmm. And it was still kind of opaque enough that it was hard to necessarily know where it would take me. Like you said, I did those internships. I got the chance to work at MLB after my sophomore year of college during that summer. Wrote some pieces for BP. Got the opportunity to intern for the Padres the summer after I graduated, and then went on to what was then the Devil Rays. And at the time, you know, it was just like something I knew I was passionate about. I knew it was something that I wanted to do, but I don't know that I knew enough about it to be able to pinpoint this is specifically the job I want to have. It was just a field that I thought was really exciting, and I was hopeful to get in and contribute.
So with that 05 Devil Rays team, which I've forgotten about that piece of it, but which, interestingly enough, I looked it up today, includes, I'm going to give all, half of our listeners a heart attack naming some of these names, but Julio Lugo, Carl Crawford, mm-hmm. Nick Green, Kevin Cash, interestingly enough, Casey Fossum, Hideo Nomo, and current Sea Dogs pitching coach Lance Carter, yep. among the other names on that team. And not that you were in yep. the dugout every game or anything, but I guess... at that time, what is a first year intern doing for the organization?
It was a really unique time in the organization because we were going through the early stages of an ownership change, mm-hmm. Where Stu Sternberg, who is now the principal owner, had bought a portion of the club but was not yet the control person. Mm-hmm. So Matt Silverman and Andrew Friedman were there, but they were not there in the right. you know, the role that Matt is still in, and then the role that Andrew ascended to. Mm-hmm. And Andrew's on the baseball ops side, and you know, doing a number of different things. And there was a sense that at some point there would be this ownership change. Mm-hmm. So that was a very unique time, and knowing that there was this change afoot, and you know, getting to work for Andrew and interact with him, but also the great blessing mm-hmm. of my time there was that I really sort of got placed in player development and scouting. And so I spent my first month there. First month was in the office, but then my second month I was at minor league spring training. And the Devil Rays at that time were split between two places, 15 minutes apart. And I was over at the minor league complex. And then when it came time for the draft, I got to help out in the draft room. But I really got this grassroots education in baseball. And I was immersed in it, you know, at the complex. And got to learn from some incredible people, many of whom are still there, who really, you know, between folks on the development side or even some of our scouts, you know, who would see games from the Trop. I just got to spend time around a lot of people with tremendous, tremendous experience in the game, and learn from them. And of course, I also got to work for Andrew and learn from him. So I got this multifaceted, but really grassroots baseball education. It does not get much more grassroots than extended spring training at what was then the Nemoli Complex in St. Petersburg. And this was before minor league nutrition was as advanced as it was now. So there was, you know, Firehouse Subs and Boston Market, and that was what we fed. Everybody got fed, including the players, with no disrespect to those fine food purveyors, but
I'm surprised it's even that good.
Yeah, you really got to see a lot of things up close that I had not been exposed to. You know, everything that my education in the game had been about before I came in was about, you know, looking at mostly the major leagues and major league players and major league performance and everything else, as it is, I think, for a lot of people, was kind of behind the curtain. And that was where I got to spend most of my time. And so I got this incredible education. And really, like, everything that is all the parts of the iceberg that are underneath the surface, which, mm-hmm. as you guys know, on some level in every good organization are the lifeblood of that organization. So I'm really grateful that that's where I started out. And because of the where the organization was and this ownership change then happening at the end of 05 and us having such a skeleton crew, I really then, once I came on full time, got to have a little taste of everything because we just didn't have very many people. So it was just an incredible experience that I don't even really think is possible in baseball now because organizations are so much more built out that I really got to do a little bit of everything. Even as I was specializing, so to speak, in player development, I got to do a little bit of everything from day one.
So that's interesting because one thing that I wanted to ask you about really delves into that is, so you kind of get put on this baseball ops track. Eventually you become, in 08, the assistant director of baseball ops. And I guess for a lot of people think like the front office, everyone is doing everything, which is, you know, it's, you know, they're attributing the 25th round pick to, you know, to you. They're attributing the 50K international signing, the development of a particular player, but it's really, there's a lot of people involved in different things and specializing, but then there's some who do a little bit of everything. How did that, I guess, what did the baseball ops track that you got put into mean as you were coming up through it, as you're starting out from there? Because I guess you're starting with a lot of the player dev stuff, like you said. What are you involved in once you get in that, maybe 08 would be the time where you're the assistant director and then become the, you know, the director and then the VP and senior VP, yeah, with expanding roles. But yeah, go ahead.
So when I was assistant director, that was actually still assistant farm director.
It was, okay.
The change to the baseball ops title came after 2011. Mm-hmm. Okay. But like I said, I think my experience was very atypical in that I really was doing a little bit of everything. I would probably spend, it was probably at least half of my time on player development, probably about 2/3. But there were all these other things that I would be a part of, both just as a function of having gotten there really early in the course of this turnover, just great timing to come in at the beginning of a complete organizational change. And that at the time that change happened, we just had very few people, mm-hmm, in the front office. So I did really get to do a little bit of everything. And a lot of it was player development, you know, everything you could possibly imagine, from, you know, working with Mitch Lukovics, who was the farm director for many years there, still there as a senior advisor, working with him on, you know, rosters and player moves and development plans and mission statements and philosophy and things like that. But also, you know, meal money and bus schedules and the things that make the trains run on time. Mm-hmm. So it was really, you know, every aspect of it. And then, you know, I might, depending on what you're doing, I might spend parts of my day on, you know, research for trades, or, you know, sitting in the draft room if it was that time of year, or going down to our facilities in the Dominican and Venezuela as we were getting those off the ground, because when Stu took over the club, we had not had an international program under the previous administration. It had pretty much been shuttered, at least from a standpoint of having an academy. So there was sort of a startup mentality there too. So it really varied. Like I just got to do a whole lot of different things, even as the focus was on player development. I'd say there was, you know, no part of the organization that at some point I wasn't at least helping with, even on a part-time basis.
And I guess this could be early on or even later on. Were there any particular experiences, and you did list some, and maybe that's the answer, but were there any particular experiences with the Rays that helped you, that there were really kind of, you know, milestone sort of experiences that you had that helped to prepare you to become a CBO or GM?
Gosh, it's the, you know, part of the reason that I pause is just because there's so many. I think it all kind of contributes. In fact, sometimes you don't even realize what's contributing the most until you encounter a problem or an issue, or, you know, some, it could be sort of something in the culture that you say, you know what, I've seen this before, or, you know, I remember we encountered this same problem here, and you didn't even realize at the time that it was going to come up again or going to inform you in some way. You know, it's hard to pick out, you know, just one thing. There's this obvious sort of top line story of us very quickly and really ahead of schedule, everything coming together for us to win a pennant in 08, which I know is a little bit of a rough salt in the wound around here.
Yeah.
But you know, I think that was, there was a lot of, I think some of the lesson in that is the power of culture in terms of both in our clubhouse, what Joe was able to accomplish coming in and really changing the culture and getting buy-in from the players, and also the culture we had in the organization, which at the time I got there, a lot of people in baseball thought, hey, it's great. You know, you got a fresh start in this place. Everybody's buying in, everybody's drinking the Kool-Aid, but man, it's just, you know, in that division, you just can't win there. And like, we basically, the biggest lesson that I think the entire 15 years taught me is you have to worry about who you are and who you need to be. You can't worry about what people on the outside are thinking you need to be. You can't worry about what your competitors are. You have to figure out what advantages you have and lean into them. And obviously, in a smaller market, that may be a more sort of obvious maxim because the advantages may not be as clear. But every situation has advantages and disadvantages, And the organizations that do the best are the ones that realize what they got going for them and lean into it really hard. And they realize some things that they can't change and they don't try to change those things. Or maybe if there's some things that aren't working well that can be changed, you focus on them. But it's just having a belief and, you know, the value of everybody understanding the mission and being on board, you know, with their different experiences and different areas of expertise to contribute to that mission. And that was actually something when I was there in the early years, we viewed what the Red Sox were doing as a, sort of a new frontier in the way a big market club can do that really creatively and can do that not just looking at the Major League roster, but looking at it as a whole organization. And I really believe, like, you know, Theo had that quote of the scouting and player development machine. Mm-hmm. That is like the true roots, the true resting place of the last two decades of Red Sox baseball, and something that I've said to a lot of people around here, like that is, we need to get back to that, except the table stakes for what that means in 2021 are so much different from what they meant back then. And the competition is so much stiffer, but this is not uncharted territory for the Red Sox. This is something that has been done here before, and we gotta get back there and do it again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, kind of your starting in the organization. You come up and there's basically this brain trust that develops with the Rays of, you know, of course, Andrew Friedman was in charge from basically 06 to 14. He leaves to join the Dodgers. There's Matt Silverman, you, Eric Neander. How did the decision-making work in that front office when you've got that group of very talented, you know, front office guys who, for a while, every opening that comes up, one of you guys or multiple of you guys is getting mentioned as being in play there. You know, how did that work? How did you guys divvy things up? And then, you know, what do you take from that experience, especially at the end, coming over into this job, where what of how to run things in the front office, how to, you know, have the top level decision making work?
Yeah, it varied over time, and you know, there were points in time when it flowed very naturally, and points of transition where we had to figure out how best to make it work. And, you know, we work extremely collaboratively. I think it's amazing how much you can accomplish when no one's bringing an ego into the room.
Right.
When you're worried about trying to get it right and not necessarily about who's right. And when you just have a really high trust environment, a lot of free flowing back and forth, people feel free to say whatever's on their mind. You know, at the end of the day, somebody needs to end the conversation, of course. But we were able to get a lot done just by you know, focusing on that and focusing on, you know, at the end of the day, we all have the intent here to support each other. We're all looking to do the right thing for the organization. And we're going to come at this with a really humble mindset. That doesn't mean we don't believe in ourselves. What it means is that we understand that there's a lot that we don't know. So we have to always stay curious and just be open to what other people in the room think. And even a lot of the things about the game of baseball that we don't understand, that probably in a year or two or five or 10, we might understand a little bit better. And just try to come up with sound processes that you can trust to make decisions. And again, not everything is black and white. You know, there's going to be those 51, 49 calls that, you know, somebody's got to make a decision. And that's why you have an organizational structure. But I think we were able to accomplish so much because we valued contributions from everywhere. And nobody came in the room with an ego that because they had a certain job title or a certain resume that their thought mattered more than somebody else's thought.
Mm-hmm. When you first came over to the Red Sox, did you have any particular, like, concrete sort of goals? Obviously, you've talked about wanting to set this team up for sustained success. And that's been clear in the way you've operated. But have there been any sort of concrete milestones you've wanted to hit or certain things you wanted to implement or anything like that? And how would you say the progress is on those goals?
Well, whatever specific goals I might have had in that regard, we kind of had to reassess once the pandemic hit and we stopped having a season for a period of time.
Fair.
And didn't really end up having a minor league season. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I didn't necessarily have something to that level of specificity in my head. A lot of it, you know, I think when you have a bigger picture goal, there's going to be a lot of different opportunities along the way to take steps towards it. You just have to make sure that at every turn you're consistently doing the right thing, that the things you are doing are aligned with that bigger picture goal. And when you do that, I think if you really do it consistently and relentlessly enough, and if it's a good goal and people are working together well, you sometimes find that you get there a little sooner than you thought you would because you were disciplined to do the right thing, not try to take shortcuts. It was, you know, I sort of roughly, like I told you guys, I thought, okay, year one, obviously in terms of the roster, there are going to be some things that are that are going to happen right up front, and then some things that might happen over the course of the year. But, you know, behind the curtain, I thought, you know, by the end of this year, hopefully you got a pretty good idea of how the entire organization runs. How is our staff aligned? Is it aligned the right way? Are there, you know, how do we need to challenge each department, each person? I view a lot of my responsibility as basically trying to lift everybody up who works in this department. And I know that sounds cheesy, but, you know, it's not always just peaches and cream. Some of it is by challenging people. Some of it is by trying to see the world maybe a little bit differently than they might and say, you know, what can I contribute? Even though I might not have the knowledge base or the expertise that they have, what can I contribute here? Or how can I push them to kind of level up and just be wherever we are? Doesn't matter if it's first or 30th or anywhere in between, to try to get to that next level and to try to set goals to do that. So I think we're able to do that in some aspects this year, although there's definitely parts of the organization that I just come into year two not really knowing as well as I would have in a normal year. But I do think, you know, there's a lot of ways in which we've been able to do that. You know, our staff and our processes have evolved a little bit differently because of the pandemic. Some things it's put under the microscope and we've been able to really focus on them, and then there are some things that we haven't even really been able to do or see. Mm-hmm. But I think as far as getting sort of a full-on tour of the organization and having a good idea of how I feel about all areas of it, I think given where we're at and what was possible this year, I certainly think I know a lot more than I did.
Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of alluded to this when talking about the player development machine statement and how that's a different thing now. It used to be that there were so many ways that a team with, you know, I guess I'll use the rough term financial muscle, but resources maybe is the better way to put it, like the Red Sox, could use that. For example, you know, you could, yeah, there's payroll, but there's also spending money on the draft, spending money internationally. Now you have a CBT that it's not a salary cap, but it certainly, you know, does put some limitations on things. You've got effectively a hard draft cap. You have a literal hard IFA cap. What are the ways now that a team like the Red Sox, that maybe this isn't the year to ask, but in a typical year, that you see that the Red Sox can use those resources, can apply those resources in a way that's smart to help create an advantage?
Yeah, I think that's one of the questions that really all teams are asking themselves, but certainly large market clubs have to address in a different way from how they used to. And like you pointed out, you know, we will someday, but until we're able to pack 35,000 plus into Fenway on a nightly basis, we don't have all the advantages we normally have in a lot of different ways. But I think we're all asking ourselves how to apply those. When I was with the Rays, we sort of viewed it this way, that behind the scenes on infrastructure, on programs, the same limitations don't necessarily exist. And so we need to act like a big market team in terms of how we staff ourselves, in terms of the attention we place on this. And to me, that's been some of the inefficiency that's existed in this game, is, you know, that teams have not necessarily been as purposeful in how they allocate resources to things that are not major league payroll. But those things are really important, and they have huge returns on investment. They're harder to measure, but they're incredibly important. And so when you look at, you know, like I said, I think the roots of the Red Sox under this ownership are very much in that direction. But when you look at what the Dodgers are doing, what the Yankees are doing, it's not an accident how they're staffed. And it's not an accident what they focus on behind the scenes in terms of staffing, in terms of infrastructure, facilities, technology, data, other projects that they look at that obviously only pay off when they pay off in terms of, you know, generating those talented young players that form the cores of championship clubs. But doing that well, you give yourself a chance to get, you know, one or two or three more guys on the good side of the fence. You get the chance to have a good player become a great player, or a fringe player become a big leaguer of some kind, or have currency in a trade. And so it's trying to eke out all of those edges. To me, I always looked at it as, the large market clubs have the ability to dominate every area of the battlefield. that is one of the biggest advantages we have. There's no reason we should just be focusing on the deep end of the pool and let other clubs have the shallow end to themselves. We can and we should be everywhere, and that's a big challenge. It takes a lot of different things for an organization to fire on all cylinders, but there's no reason we shouldn't care just as much about waiver claims or minor league free agents, or, you know, what minor league nutrition or, you know, any of those areas as we care about, you know, the top free agents on the market. We should be able to do it all. And that's really, I think, that the big picture goal that a club like ours can aspire to.
Do you think, and you know, I'll ask this and then you can get into the one you're about to ask, but do you think the Red Sox were doing a good job of that, or at least the best job they could do at that when you arrived? And granted, like you said, you haven't been able to see the full apparatus in action yet, really. But what is your take on how well they were doing those things?
Yeah, it's hard to say because I think, you know, still what I know of that time is mostly still an outside view. And I know that the roots of the culture here and a lot of the people that have been just organizational stalwarts here over, you know, so many years, you know, are fully invested, you know, philosophically in that and take a lot of pride in it. And that's one thing that I've noticed about this organization in a lot of aspects is that you talk to a lot of people who played here or a lot of people who worked here. And, you know, people have different experiences. Some people liked the experience they had. Some people didn't. You know, obviously it depends on how it went, what kind of success they had, how well they played, how much they got booed, whatever. But people leave this organization thinking, man, like that was first class. Like they did it right. And that is something that is very powerful that I think the Red Sox have always had. I do think in some sense, you know, with the Rays, we put so much pressure on ourselves to make sure that a lot of those nooks and crannies that teams might run past that we were going to get in there and really maximize them. And so there were definitely some things when I came over here that I said, okay, like I can contribute something in these areas. There's some meat on the bone here. So were we doing it as well when I came here as the Red Sox could? I'd probably say no, but I think that's still the case. I think the key is to have a mindset where that is always the case. This is a game where, especially the way it's moving right now, you have to run really quickly just to stand still. And our job is to try to outrun all the other clubs. So there were some of those areas where I came in and thought that I could contribute. There are also other areas where I looked at and said, man, they're doing this pretty well. I'm going to learn a lot by watching this. And talking about coming in here a year removed from one of the most dominant seasons in baseball history and accomplishing something that I have yet to accomplish. So I'm very mindful of that, too, and what I can learn from that and what it takes to get to the top of the mountain with that kind of dominance. So I think it's a mix.
Kind of piggybacking on what you just said, obviously you came in and there was a lot of established members of the front office that have remained in place. And I know one area, and you kind of going back a little further too, you mentioned that hasn't got off the ground because of what happened last year when it comes to scouting. The Rays did and how the scouting style, both with minor league scouting and amateur, kind of how you did it with the Rays, influence what you are kind of pushing the Red Sox in the ways you want to push it here? Or did you, since the people in place were here before you, you've kind of come in and learned from them, you're blending the two together or just sticking with what they've done?
You know, I think it's somewhere in between because I think a lot of the ways that processes were evolving under the hood here are very similar to some of the evolution that, you know, I had been a part of with the Rays. Just in terms of, you know, there are some similarities. In both cases, you have an organization that has a lot of stability and a staff that, while there's obviously people that come and go, a lot of the staff, and this is true of the scouting staffs in both organizations on the amateur side, there's a lot of people who have been there for a very long time. And there's a lot of trust. There's a lot of cohesion. And they've done a lot of good work. And I think where a lot of the evolution comes is then, once those scouts do their work over the course of the year, how do you bring that information together to build the best draft board you can and make the best decisions you can? And I actually, you know, showed up here in the middle of a lot of conversations and a lot of evolution that was very similar to some stuff that I had experienced with the Rays, and coincidentally also came about when you had, you know, an internal transition from one scouting director to another. Where the prior scouting director, who's still an enormously respected and influential person in the organization, who's still a huge part of the scouting process. So I had lived that before and saw in a very good way a lot of the same things here. So having lived that, there were some things that I think I was able to bring to the table in terms of guidance and suggestions and, you know, questions that I could challenge the group with and challenge Paul with. And, you know, I didn't get to see the draft meetings in their normal form because they were on Zoom. Mm-hmm. you know, so there were some things that I thought I could contribute, but I think very much a lot of the questions that this group was asking themselves were very similar to the questions that I would have come in here and asked.
Okay, one area that, you know, you guys had a lot of success with the Rays, and that the Red Sox have, rightly or wrongly, certainly been criticized for, especially in past years, is developing pitching. Notably, in particular with starting pitching. Have you come in with any kind of ways that, or whether it's you or not, what ways do you think the organization has changed the way they evaluate or scout or develop pitching to try and change that, to try and attack that? And maybe part of that might be, you know, the roles of pitchers are also evolving. So how does that affect things too? Maybe it's two different questions, but, you know, how have those two aspects changed since you've come in?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's something that I was asking myself when I came in here, because obviously I was fortunate to be a part of a lot of success in that regard with the Rays. And I'm not, you know, so full of myself as to think that all that was necessarily deserved. But I do think we had a lot of really good people that worked together well. We had some good processes. And, you know, I came in knowing what I knew and being around what I had been around with the idea of, well, this is an area that I sort of want to dive into and get a sense of how we do things. And I'm sure I'm going to find some things that are really good. And in fact, I do think under the hood, there's a lot of things already in progress that had started before I got here that are relatively recent that I think are going to pay dividends. And then I also think that they're, you know, some of the fruits of the pitching program were used as currency to bring that championship here. So, and, you know, if those guys were still here, and they're not, and everybody has rings because of it, which is fine. But if they were still here, I think people may look a little differently at it. Now, all that said, and again, this year was tough because we weren't operating normally. But I did, and, you know, something that, you know, with, you know, particularly with BOH and with Ben Crockett and Brian Abraham over the course of the year, have some thoughts, some observations, some questions, just anything that stood out to me as a little different, or is something that I would observe. Hey, I'm used to hearing things talked about this way, and now over here, here's the type of conversation that I hear. And I have shared some thoughts. I don't want to, you know, those I want to keep behind the curtain. And we've had some really good conversation about it. There are some, you know, larger philosophical things, you know, some things, you know, about what we're trying to get out of our program and the things we ask ourselves. And, you know, the ways we would want our staff and our players to answer the question of, you know, what are we asking a Red Sox pitcher to be? What are we asking them to do from the moment they get in the organization? We've had a lot of those types of conversations. There have been, I think, questions I've been able to ask and, you know, things that I've felt strongly about that I've been around that I think have been helpful. But I've also been really impressed. You know, it's not an issue of not having good people here. It's not an issue of not caring or, you know, not, you know, wanting this to turn out well. I think there's a lot of good things in place, but I'm hopeful that there are things that I've been able to contribute that are going to, you know, enhance what we're trying to do.
And then just in terms of you know, what the Rays are, of course, known in large part, not, well, the evolution of pitching roles, a lot of people do attribute certain things like the opener, you know, in large part to the Rays, to making that a thing. And we've seen the way that, like, long relievers or bulk relievers or whatever, pitchers are being used differently. It's evolved over the history of the game, but it seems like in the past 3, 4, maybe 5 years, that's changing at light speed compared to, you know, going from Goose Gossage and Mike Marshall to, you know, the closer Eckersley style. As far as building a Red Sox team, building a pitching staff, and with some of the guys you have, you know, we hear about Darwin's and Hernandez comes up. He's a reliever. We're thinking maybe we can stretch him out and get a little bit more out of him. We're looking at him as one inning reliever guy now. How, you know, approaching building that pitching staff, how do you view roles now? Is it, you know, I mean, obviously this year was a little different for any number of reasons, so maybe 2020 is its own thing, but maybe it's not. How do you see how you build a pitching staff changing, and how do you use that and the front end to develop those pitchers, to scout, develop, evaluate those guys?
Yeah, I think where a lot of that came from, and what I think is important not to lose in this, is that it wasn't born out of an idea of, hey, you know, philosophically we want the staff to look a certain way. It basically was an outgrowth of one of the main tenets in development there, and in, you know, as well as at the big league level, where Kyle Snyder and Stan Baroski do such a wonderful job, is how can we maximize this individual player? And we basically just started looking at that more zoomed out of, you know what, why are we taking everybody and trying to make them either this six-inning, 100-pitch starter or this one-inning short reliever? And the only players who ever do anything that's not that are, like, guys who never get to pitch in meaningful situations. It doesn't necessarily have to be that way. And we thought, whether it's kind of a way station for a young pitcher that you're trying to break in, or maybe a permanent spot for someone who has more to contribute than maybe isn't the type of guy who's going to be most successful trying to just blow it out for an inning, but also might not be suited to turn a lineup over two or three times. Maybe there's a way that we can maximize this guy's impact in some role in between. And let's just look at what's best for each individual guy. Now, as we worked on that, we did find that there are some reasons why staffs were the way they were, that you can't just look at everybody in a vacuum and throw it all against the wall and expect it to work. Guys need routine and they need predictability. And, you know, that's where some of the opener model actually evolved from, was actually giving some of those bulk guys a little more regular turn, and then figuring out how to maximize them. But, you know, one of the things, like a lot of conversation that I had last spring when I came here with our staff, was that there is not necessarily some sort of, you know, philosophical default that I come to. What it really is about, you know, getting out of the box of just doing it the way we've always done it and saying, here's who we have. What's the best way to position this group to win the most in a way that still takes care of their arms? That we're not going to trade off health, and we're not compromising our responsibility to ourselves and to our pitchers to take care of their arms and their careers. And it's obviously also good for us if they stay healthy. How, within that, can we use these guys to win as much as possible? And these advantages are not necessarily huge, but usually in the American League East, the margin's pretty slim. So any advantage that you can get, you owe it to yourself to pursue. And, you know, there are some unexpected benefits that came from it. So some of that, I think, comes from who your pitchers are. It starts with just trying to pile up as many talented pitchers as possible, and it just gives you more ways to deploy them and more ways that they can succeed.
As I take myself off mute here. Or Ian, did you want to do this?
Yeah, sure. I guess kind of piggybacking off adding as many talented pitchers as possible. Looking back at last year's trade deadline, obviously you guys were pretty active. You made four trades at the deadline?
Or that sounds right.
At the time preceding it.
Yeah.
And when you looked at the roster, when you were talking about those potential deals, did you have specific positions you were targeting, or was it really you just went in with, we're going to look at the entire organization, talk to our guys, look at our, you know, analytics, and identify the best possible players regardless of position? Because it seems like in those trades you were able to address some of the kind of the weaker areas in the current system, and I'm just wondering if that was a deliberate tactic or it was more just how it kind of ended up happening.
Yeah, some of it was more of a happy coincidence. You know, I really think, like, if we can get our system to the point that we are so jammed up that we cannot accommodate certain talented players, that's a great spot to be in. It's really hard to get to that spot. I'm not sure anybody ever really gets to that spot. So you got to focus on the talent first. But that said, I mean, that was, you know, part of the reason, you know, for instance, with the deal with Philadelphia, that was really attractive to us, because not only did we like the talent, but it also, you know, with both guys, both filled needs, where we have Nick Pivetta who we think is ready to go, you know, be turned loose and see what he can do, you know, with an everyday turn on a major league club. And then we knew, you know, and last season showed it, we really suffered for lack of upper minors, you know, big league ready players. It wasn't really till the end of the year when we got Tanner up here that we had someone that we were excited about, that we could run out there excited about as a prospect. So adding Connor, you know, was really big with that. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think when you try to get too cute, it's sort of like the draft. When you try to get too cute about, we have to fill this hole or that hole, usually those things work themselves out one way or the other. And the beauty of the minor leagues is that you have time for those things to work themselves out. So as long as you can give somebody enough at bats or enough innings to develop, that's really all that matters. If you get to the point where you actually are cannibalizing somebody else's opportunity, maybe then you have to think about it, but usually that just ends up being a tiebreaker in certain cases.
And then as far as, you know, last year, another thing you had to deal with that was a little different was the COVID draft, is I guess what I would call it, and that it's five rounds. The team doesn't even have a second rounder, so you've got four picks. And, you know, a lot has been said about the Red Sox draft last year, although I think it seems like the kind of general, you know, baseball public opinion of what you guys did is already kind of shifting, it seems, very quickly. When you look at taking Nick York and seeing what he did at the ATS. How did you guys approach that draft in differently, knowing what you had, both in terms of four picks generally, knowing you didn't have a second rounder? What changed as far as your strategy and you know, going a little off the board in the first round, frankly, with what was generally accepted? And we've discussed how it might be a little different this year. But, you know, how did that shape up coming into that draft? The decision to take Nick York in the first, Blaze Jordan in the third, and I guess generally with your draft strategy, you know, which I guess you could have even been a little bit more involved in, given how little there was to get your head around in terms of a normal 40 pick draft.
Yeah. You know, it stunk being hamstrung like that. You know, it is what it is. There obviously was a shorter draft. And you know, the penalty that came out of the investigation, which, you know, happened for a reason. So that it stunk. It was, we were going into that with one hand behind our backs, but we had to make the most of it. And I give Paul, and Devin Pearson and that whole group, like a ton of credit for how they handled it. And also for, you know, really, I think at the end of the day, what it came down to is not us trying to do something that was off the board because we, you know, got a kick out of doing something that was off the board, but believing in it and not being scared off of it just because it was different. If the only reason that we don't do something is that we're worried about criticism, that's not a good enough reason. We should never operate like that. We have to be willing to do what we believe is right, even if we're going to get criticized. And we knew that it would come with some blowback because Nick wasn't a hyped player. We also had a lot of belief in the player and also belief that if we had had a normal spring, he would have been seen. You know, a lot of things kind of conspired with him having been hurt the year before and not having played the field the year before. And if you weren't there and really all over him those first few weekends, you did not have enough information on Nick York to really think anything about him. And even within that, there are different – we could have had a full spring, and there still would have been a lot of different opinions in the industry, you know, about the player, about the profile. But we had really strong belief in the evaluation that we had. And, you know, we went through a very rigorous process about how to build our board. And, look, there are certainly ways the draft could have fallen where – we might have ended up taking someone else. It wasn't that we were hell-bent on saving money in that round to go spend it later. But, you know, given what the board looked like when it got to our pick, we felt, you know, very, very clearly to us it made sense, you know, to take Nick there. And then, we liked the player a lot, and then also felt like we had some savings we could do damage with later in the draft. But it really has to start with believing in the player. Because it was going to be a long time before we were going to pick again. Right. And you can't necessarily count on what you're going to be able to do with those savings. But we also felt like we had enough intel, that there were enough clubs that were aligned with us on Nick, that waiting for him to be around at pick number 89 was also not a good strategy. And this is a player we wanted.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And I feel you on that long wait. The two of us did a mock draft, and we literally just went and had dinner and came back.
Yeah. Hey, I'm used to having those extra picks. Come here and have fewer picks. I was miserable.
Well, next time we have you on, we'll have to ask about the 11 pick year or whatever it was that the Rays had. I think that was the Snell year.
Tails that year.
Well, the Red Sox would love to have a draft like that every year. Put it that way.
Yes, I think every club would love to have that draft every year.
Luck into that in the fifth round. But another thing too that you would, at least it popped into my head hearing you're answering. We're approaching a year in which the minor league infrastructure is going to be very different. Losing for the Red Sox at least a level, for some teams two levels. We still don't know fully what it's going to look like yet. Maybe if you can enlighten us on some of the things that have been decided that have been reported, I'm guessing that's not going to be the case. But what changes are you guys already making that you can share with us in terms of, you know, how are things going to look different other than, you know, not just in the sense of we're all going to say Greenville when we mean Salem and vice versa this year, but, you know, how you're going to approach where guys are at, how are you going to approach, you know, is there going to be something we hear about learning lessons from the alternate training site that can be carried forward? Are we going to have things like guys heading to Fort Myers for a couple weeks or something like that? What is there anything that's going to change that you know of that's concrete that is going to be clear? Or do you think it's going to be more subtle? How do you see that playing out with the changes that are being made? Assuming that everything goes off. Like,
right. Well, that's the thing is we're still, awaiting detail on the ins and outs of the new layout, although there's been some things that we've been, we've learned in the abstract about it. But B, the world is still not normal, and it may not be normal for a long time. So that is, it's kind of a double whammy there, obviously. Mm-hmm. I think we do know enough to know it's not, even though we will not have, short season affiliate, we're going to have more than just a GCL roster's worth of players, out of our complex. Mm-hmm. And what that means, obviously we're still trying to figure out, and a lot of that, again, the pandemic is still ruling everything we do. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things we don't know about that. I think this might affect us more profoundly if we had previously had three short season clubs, like some organizations do. Mm-hmm. That it didn't, I think, sort of a blessing in disguise in a sense, in terms of this kind of condensing in the minor leagues. I think the one thing that is pretty clear is what we do at the complex is going to take on an extra level of importance. And I think teams are going to have a little more freedom, and more, also more responsibility, but a little more freedom in how they set that up. I do think it's reasonable to expect there's going to be some kind of league, but there may also be other things that we can do with players or choose to do with players where, like you said, some of the things we learned at the alternate site where we had to be creative, where we couldn't play games or real games against outside competition, and sometimes not even against ourselves.
Right.
Some of those lessons may be applicable. And I think that's going to be a great challenge and really an exciting challenge where organizations are going to be able to separate themselves by what they do with players, not just at the affiliates, as we've always been able to do, but also at the complex. And there's going to be more options, and it's going to be a little more of a blank canvas. And so that's a challenge. It's on us to figure out what do we want to do with it. And I think it's going to reward creativity.
Do you know if there's any chance that there'd be two GCL teams?
Don't know yet. Mm-hmm. As far as what short season is going to look like, there's still a lot that needs to be worked out. And again, it's really, I don't even know that we can work it out now because we don't know yet, what the minor leagues will look like, even out at the affiliates, given where we are with the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. I guess kind of a related question. The Red Sox alternate training site roster, if you want to call that this year, it included fewer younger guys, especially at the beginning, than some other teams did. Some teams brought in 5, 6, 7, 8, 18, 19-year-olds, whereas with the Red Sox, it was basically like, as far as guys that weren't necessarily there as potential MLB depth, it was like Groom and then some guys that came later, maybe a couple of other younger guys. But it wasn't as extensive, and it was clearly, you wound up using most of them, frankly. So it was, clearly for a reason. We're hearing, and maybe this is a little too much speculation, but it's been reported that there might be an MLB/AAA spring training, and then there might be a minor league, everybody else type spring training. A, do you know if that's the case? If you know, that'd be great. But if that's the case, do you see the team doing something similar going into this year where it's mostly that, or would there be like a chance for a Casas type guy to slip in? And again, maybe the whole question's moot for right now.
Yeah, and definitely reasonable to think that we're not going to be able to do both camps at the same time, just from a sure. distancing perspective. I don't think that's news. The exact parameters of what that means for big league camp. And, of course, it takes a lot of players to run a major league camp.
Right.
And to do right by people. And one thing to remember when you're talking about a spring training situation, we will have to weigh that decision between getting guys the exposure versus not necessarily ramping up some guys to be game ready in late February when their season might not start for months.
Sure.
And there's trade-offs there too that we are talking about right now, exactly how we're going to balance. And it was somewhat similar last summer. I think last summer we knew coming in that we were going to be up against it in terms of how our pitching staff laid out. And we didn't necessarily know what the season would bring. We were very fortunate, and thanks to a lot of good work by a lot of people, our players, our staff, our medical staff, we didn't have a positive test post-intake. So we didn't have that disaster scenario where we had to empty out the alternate site. Mm-hmm. That when we had that, it was because we couldn't get 27 outs efficiently,
right,
night after night. But we knew we needed to insulate against that, and we knew that once you added players, they were, if it was a prospect that you cared about, they were going to be on the whole way. And You know, so we weren't going to, we didn't ever want to be in the situation where we were going feel like we had to, we were going to be forced to, you know, put somebody who has a bright future ahead of them, but is definitely not ready for the situation, to have to add them. Because that is not something you can undo, and there's a lot of negative downstream effects, both for the roster and also for the player doing that. And we didn't know exactly what it was going to bring, so we kept it fairly small at the outset, and we left ourselves room to work with in that player pool, and we kind of adjusted as we went along and figured out what our needs were. Looking back on it, there's probably a couple things we would have done differently with that now that we know how things played out, but we thought we needed, you know, a buffer to guard against some of those disaster scenarios that could have happened.
How, you know, we've talked about the pandemic. How is that affecting how you build a roster right now? And there's various aspects to that. There's the fact that guys only played so much last year, guys playing in the winter, what you can expect from them in the coming year. I mean, all kinds of other things in terms of what you need to build in terms of depth. How is that different than what you've seen needed to think about in previous years in terms of building out not just the 26-man roster, but the 40-man roster and other minor league depth?
Yeah, I think it will probably play out differently, but I'm trying, you know, I don't think we want to get too cute about it, because to me, so much of my, you know, training, both from people that I've learned from and also from the experiences that I've had, has focused on the importance of depth. And that is kind of a hidden aspect of teams that really separates playoff teams from non-playoff teams. I felt, you know, and I've said this within the organization, I think I've said it publicly, I felt like 2019, my last year with the Rays, the depth or lack thereof was the separator in the division. All three, you know, us and the, when I say us, I'm not even sure who I'm referring to when I talk about 2019, but the Rays, the Red Sox, and the Yankees all had many injuries during the course of that season. And the order of finish was really consistent with how well the depth came through. The Yankees' depth was outstanding, and they got these terrific performances from guys like Urshela and Voit and, you know, players like that that really gave them, like, everyday player caliber performances. Ray's depth also came through and was outstanding, and here it wasn't, and you could see it kind of fall apart. So I think we already had a long way to go in that regard, and that was one of the I don't want to say easiest, but one of the clearest ways to improve the roster, because the frontline talent was really good. And so improving the depth is already going to be such a priority that I'm not sure that the pandemic could have ratcheted up more for me, because I just thought this is something that we need to dominate, and we should be able to improve without you know, having to do anything that's going to detract from our long-term goal. If anything, it should only enhance it. You know, the more options we give ourselves, you know, the more players we're going to have where we can really benefit if you get an Urshela type outcome and somebody becomes an everyday player.
I mean, have you had to become mindful of things like revenue projections for the coming year and things like that? I mean, is that, I mean, granted, maybe coming from the Rays, this is something you're used to having to worry about, but, and I don't say that, you know, just kind of offhand, but it's just, it's not something that with the Red Sox we're used to having to think about as fans or people who watch the team. I mean, well, is that something that you think of, or is it just...
Yeah, even during normal times, I think it's probably thought of within the walls of teams like ours more than people appreciate. And we're fortunate, you know, we have an ownership here that has always backed this team to the hilt financially. Mm-hmm. We're just going through something that's unprecedented.
Sure.
It's not a secret what kind of economic engine a full Fenway Park is. And we're now running, you know, that's the economic engine that funds the payroll and funds so much of what we do. It's not the only one, but it's a big part of it, and that we are now, you know, without. So that's having a real impact. I mean, there's no question, you know, we're taking a huge hit, took a hit last year, going to take another hit this year. You know, that's going to have its effects, but I also think, you know, given that, you know, we have an ownership that's in this for the long haul. We have an ownership that is measuring this in terms of wanting to win, you know, the fifth and the sixth and the seventh ring. And they talk about that all the time. And so when that's the big picture goal, now I think we are positioned right now in a spot where doing that is not going to be accomplished by some of the flashy instant gratification moves that help when you are much closer to a championship. We have to lay this foundation. We got to do it the right way. We have to build up the talent base. to be able to get to that point and to feel like when we're at that point, we're going to stay at that point and we're not going to go right back into the valley. There's no question the pandemic makes that harder, but we're also fortunate that we have an ownership that is staying focused on the right things and on that end goal.
Mm-hmm. We have kind of a little bit of a grab bag for kind of the last few questions here for you, Chaim. First off, when I mentioned this earlier before we started recording, but when Theo Epstein resigned from the Cubs, and I think it was before he took the job with MLB, but he said he had a quote that was interesting. He said, "Executives like me who have spent a lot of time using analytics and other measures to try and optimize individual and team performance have unwittingly had a negative impact on the aesthetic value of the game and the entertainment value of the game in some respects." And this is something that's been talked about in kind of the baseball Twitter sphere and you know, the kind of thought pieces that you see in some outlets. How would you respond to that? What are your thoughts on kind of, you know, is this, you know, hyper sort of, I guess what Theo said, how would you respond to that sentiment, to that thought?
Yeah, I mean, long story short, I think he's right. Now, look, I also think as a game, we sometimes don't do a good enough job reminding everybody how great a product we have. I think
agreed.
Baseball is a sport that gets held to a higher standard, and sometimes we hold ourselves to a higher standard, and we shouldn't forget that this is still the greatest game on earth. But I think he's right, and I think I don't think it's anybody's fault. I think, you know, we are all trying to win, and we're trying to do everything we can to try to maximize every last little thing in order to win as much as we can. And you know, when you take 30 highly competitive organizations and turn them loose on a set of rules, on a set of boundaries, they are going to find the best way within those rules to twist that to their advantage. And what I think we have in baseball, at least in some respects, I don't think this is true everywhere. I think in terms of this, the development of our athletes, I mean, when you look at the athleticism that's on the field right now, it is just remarkable. And I feel pretty strongly that we're dealing with, like, probably on average the highest level of, like, sharpened athleticism that we've probably seen at any point in the game's history. And you look at how guys train, I mean, it's incredible. Mm-hmm. It's not that they are innately better athletes, but just the way that the training that they have access to and the way that they can develop their skills. But when it comes to game strategy and some of the ways the game is evolving, it's just unfortunate that I think, you know, I don't know a ton about some of these other sports, but you've seen in a lot of sports changes happening to the game that come solely out of teams trying to optimize strategy. And in football, I think you've seen a much more open game, a much more passing friendly game that I think the league has done some things to encourage, but it's a really exciting product. It's not the sort of battle in the trenches that you had, you know, when I was growing up, and it's just more fun. And in basketball, you have like Steph Curry bombing threes and what the Warriors turned into and kind of seemed to revolutionize the way people thought about the game. So in those sports, you have a lot of innovations that made a more exciting product. I think there's a lot of innovations that have happened in baseball that, not because anybody wishes harm on the game, but have just made the game probably less entertaining. Mm-hmm. And we are giving our players fewer chances to show off that athleticism because we don't have the ball in play as much as we should. And there's a lot of walks and strikeouts, and those take time. They take pitches. So the games take longer. And that's not going to change on the team level because we're still going to try to win in whatever environment you give us. So if you want to change it, and I think we should, then that needs to be, you know, it's a collective action problem. Mm-hmm. And that needs to come in terms of changing the structure of the game. Not, you know, we need to make sure we are very attentive to the unintended consequences of what we do. But I think we should all be invested. Look, we're competing for people's eyeballs. We're competing for their entertainment dollars. We should want this product to be as fun as possible. And we should all be in supportive of changes that create that, as long as it's happening at a league level where it's not running counter to what we need to do to win.
And then with the spotlight on the involvement of women in the sport with, you know, with Kim Ng getting hired as GM by the Marlins. You work with one of the more prominent women in the sport, in Raquel Ferreira, and the club recently hired Bianca Smith as a coach, which, so you're kind of, the organization's sort of on the forefront in that sense. How do you think getting that kind of, an additional perspective, a unique perspective, what value do you see from bringing a more inclusive atmosphere, which, I mean, I guess in terms of the question, it's women in the sport, but it could just include, you know, racial backgrounds, country backgrounds from where people are from. What do you think that brings to the table that other than just, you know, not cutting off avenues to bringing in the best people?
Yeah, I think whatever people think those benefits are, they are probably greater than that. Mm-hmm. And we still, as an industry, are not even close to realizing them fully. Mm-hmm. And it just makes sense to me that, first of all, you know, we are fooling ourselves if we think we live in a world where everybody gets a clean shot at every opportunity. And to the extent that that's not the case, that's just wrong. And we need to be very intentional about how we correct for that. And it's just a fact that when you have a lot of people who look like me in chairs like these, that we are going to have to be pretty intentional if we don't want everybody who follows us to look like us, because that tends to be how things go. But beyond that, beyond the sort of fairness and the sort of justice issue of it, we're going to benefit more if we have people that look at the world differently. And everybody looks at any problem, you know, through the prism of all the experiences that they've had. And to sit here and think that, you know, a room full of, like, I'm not surprised when you see these studies that companies that have a lot of women in leadership roles tend to outperform companies that don't. I mean, to sit here and think that a room full of men is going to have a diversity of opinion, and diversity of thought, that a room that also includes women and women who are empowered to speak, to think that, like, that just follows logically to me. And I've been fortunate, whether it's here or with the Rays, to work, you know, with some incredible women. And like I said, I don't even think we're close as an industry to getting this where it needs to be. And I think a lot of that is just going to come from maintaining focus on it and being really, really purposeful about, you know, who we open our pipeline to. I think so many of these things are not a function of there not being talented candidates. It's that the road is just looks much clearer to people who are like the people in power. And we need to make sure we are opening up those pathways very deliberately to make it very clear to people who are underrepresented in our game that this is for them too. Mm-hmm.
We hadn't originally intended this to be one of the last questions, but just with the way the conversation has flowed, it's sort of wound up this way. And I think it's been asked and answered plenty regarding a lot of things about the Mookie Betts trade. We don't need to relitigate that from top to bottom. But one thing that we were wondering about is you came from an organization where you've had to trade Evan Longoria. You've had to trade, you know, James Shields, Chris Archer. Did that experience, having to do that, prepare you for how to approach it, how to handle it during and how to handle it after? Did that, you know, did that make you more ready to have to do a move like that?
That's a good question. I think in some respects, yes. And I'll expand on that a little bit. I think number one, even though I had not myself had that sort of deep emotional connection to Mookie, I know the organization does and our fans do. And I know what it feels like to trade a player to whom you feel that connected and to have to, you know, do what you think is in the best interest of the organization, even when it runs counter to where your emotions are taking you in the moment. And so that's something I've navigated. I know what that feels like. And you know, to me, it doesn't mean that you turn off your feelings. I think you feel everything that you feel, but you still do what you think is best. You know, it also, one of the things that it made me very mindful of, because we had this experience, and especially with Evan, was trying to do what we could, even amidst all the media circus and amidst all the uncertainty of what was going to happen, because it was not a fait accompli on the day I showed up here, to try that if there was a trade, that Mookie left the organization feeling good about how we handled it with him. That's hard to do. I don't know that we accomplished it perfectly, but I hope that we tried to go about it a way that if it did happen, and then ultimately when it did happen, that he felt that, you know, whatever he thought of it, and, you know, whatever he thought of it on the merits, whatever he thought of it for himself, he at least felt like we were honest with him, like we handled it the right way, and that we gave him, you know, the respect that he deserves on the way out the door. And that's something that's not always easy to do. You know, some of it ultimately, the way the trade unfolded, it became impossible from a confidentiality standpoint because of how everything went. But even prior to that, even as we were getting close to an initial agreement, to try to keep him as much in the loop as I felt I could in good conscience, so that he felt, you know, cared for. Because, you know, when the one thing I did learn, when you have those players, even if they move on organically or even if you trade them, like what they did for your organization and who they are, and especially in the case of someone like Mookie, that doesn't go anywhere. That remains important. And you want to take care of them even as they are leaving, because some part of them is always like, it's just always going to be where they grew up. And you want them to feel good about that.
All right. Because in large part, because we don't want to close on the Mookie Betts question, because I don't want it to seem like you just sprung that on you at the end. But I'll leave this nice and open-ended for you. Give us a prediction for the coming season. Go with that as you will. A prediction for 2021 baseball season for the Boston Red Sox. I guess I'll narrow it to that.
Well, I've been telling people I think it's really hard for the Red Sox to sneak up on anybody, just generally speaking. I think we have a chance this year. I'm going to predict two things, and the second one is sort of more of an aspiration of where I think at the end of this we can look up and say, you know, regardless of how the season goes. The first one is that, you know, I just think you're going to see a really hungry group that believes that it is a lot better than what last year's record was, and I believe that too. You know, I know Alex believes that, and I think you're going to see this group really determined to show people that and come in after this with a lot of energy. I think last year, just all the circumstances of last year, everything, and then the pandemic on top of all of it really made it hard for the group to have a lot of energy. And despite that, they still played hard, but the atmosphere was not the same. And I think everybody who was here has kind of learned from that. And I think we're going to see a very, very different energy level this year. And I think we're going to be more exciting than the narrative right now is giving us credit for being. And I think a lot of that is going to be because of how the players will attack it. And then the second part of this is, you know, I even felt we accomplished this to some degree from the beginning of 20 to the end of 20, that we played pretty well down the stretch, and you were starting to see some guys on the club, not everybody that we hope to count on in future years, but a few of them step in, and you could say, okay, I can start to see, you know, what in some alternate universe this could have looked like this summer. And I'm hoping we get to the end of 21 and, you know, we're really at a point where that's even taking shape more, and you're starting to see it where, you know, where not only are we competitive in 21, but you can get really excited about saying, like, okay, that I see very clearly where the arrow is pointing. And, you know, not only, look, I think, like I said, I think we got a chance to surprise some people in 21. And, you know, I'm hopeful that and believe very much that we were going to do a few more things before opening day that will supplement this club. But that even on top of that, you know, our goal is, as you guys know, is building towards sustainable championship contention, and we will get to the end of the year, you know, hopefully having a chance to pop corks at some point, but regardless, getting to the end of the year where it is starting to look very, very clear, you know, what that, you know, multi-year window of championship contention is going to look like when it takes shape.
All right. Well, if anybody wants a dog, there's one up for adoption down in Washington, D.C. Hi, you've been extremely generous with your time. Thank you so much. We'll leave it on that. I like a hopeful, unless you want to like break a transaction or something. You got any?
No, I don't have anything up my sleeve. I wish it timed up that way, but
okay, fair enough. That's
apologies.
All right. Well, we appreciate it. Thank you so much. Hopefully, we get to speak to you again sometime on the show. In the sea of angels with the hand.